He's multi-talented.
Oh, God is multi-talented. That is quite true.
You've seen that one, haven't you?
It would. Okay, I've entitled this 16th lecture into the Gospel of John, the third sign released into the Sabbath day, a black comedy indeed. And I've referred to it as a black comedy indeed because at our last lecture, the Revitzen referred to, of course, as Laurel did, the fact that here is this person just been healed, this wonderful miracle, 38 years on his back, or his belly, whatever, it doesn't say, but certainly he was sprawled out for 38 years. Mashiach comes along, rescues him, and performs his mighty miracle, and they get upset over the violation of the Sabbath commandment. Before we start, I want to quote C.S. Lewis. Many, many years ago I read Mere Christianity. I was impressed by it. He wrote that in 1952. And C.S. Lewis, of course, is a brilliant man and a believer in a universal salvation. And one thing he could not stand about people was the fact that they would say that Yeshua was that Jesus was a great teacher. Couldn't stand it. Didn't like that. And he writes in Mere Christianity, I am trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him. Oh, I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That is the one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on the level of a man who says he is a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us never come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. Right? So that's C.S. Lewis's take on that. And when I read that many years ago, I thought, well, that's profound. Of course, you'll get the intellectuals who get on websites, and they'll say, well, it's not either or, because basically, Jesus was a legend; he never existed anyway. And, you know, so you sort of go, oh, look, you know, go away, drop kick. Don't approach me with that attitude, because I don't tolerate fools gladly. Everybody knows that, and I'm not going to start with you dickhead. Go away.
We're getting into an argument because whether
you can't argue. If someone's got their mind made up, you can't convince them otherwise. No. Why bother?
That's it.
Why bother?
Kick your feet up and go.
Why bother?
Their minds are closed.
Of course they are. And it takes God to open the mind. And I do agree, you know, Yeshua had a lot of frustration when he came, because he worked on the principle of opening men's minds in order for them to accept him. And yet, all the way through his ministry, he had closed minds that wouldn't even listen to him. And that goes further than
a refusal. Probably answering a question with a question. That was a bit of a...
Pardon?
Answering a question all the time with a question.
So let's have a look at the text again of the healing of this man. I want to take the time to do this so that we refresh where we've been in the last few lectures. So if you turn over to John 5, I'm having a bit of trouble with my voice today. You have to forgive me and bear with me. It keeps wanting to give out. Les Moon, you're a bit that way today as well.
Yeah,
must be.
Can't get it out.
No. Autumn.
It's autumn, yeah. After this, there was a festival of the Jews. And Yeshua went up to Jerusalem. Now, in Jerusalem, by the sheep gate, there is a pool. And the Greek word here means swimming pool. Called in Hebrew, Aramaic actually, Bethzaita, Azata, which has five porticos. In these lay many invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed. One man was there who had been ill for 38 years. When Yeshua saw him lying there and knew that he had been there a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be made well?" The sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no one to throw me into the pool when the water is stirred up, and while I am even making my way, someone even steps down ahead of me." Yeshua said to him, "Stand up, take your mat and walk, and keep walking." That's important. If you haven't got that in your Bible, that little addition, "and keep walking," you need to insert it because it is most profound, and I'll show you later why. At once, the man was made well. He took up his mat and began to walk about. Now that day was a Sabbath. So the Jews said to the man who had been cured, "It is the Sabbath. It's not lawful for you to carry a mat." But he answered them, "The man who made me well said to me, 'Take up your mat and walk.'" They asked him, "Who is the man who said that to you, 'Take up your bed and walk'?" Now the man who had been healed did not know who it was, for Yeshua had departed because of the crowd that was there. Later, Yeshua found him in the temple and said to him, "See, you have been made well. Do not sin anymore, so that nothing worse happens to you." The man went away and told the Jews it was Yeshua who had made him well. Therefore, the Jews started persecuting Yeshua because he was doing such things on the Sabbath. But Yeshua answered them, "My Father is still working, and I also am working." For this reason, the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him, because he was not only breaking the Sabbath, but was also calling God his own Father, thereby making himself equal to God. Yeshua said to them, "Absolutely, I'm telling you, the Son can do nothing on his own, but only what he sees the Father doing. For whatever that one does, the Son does likewise. The Father loves the Son and shows him all that he himself is doing. And he will show him greater works than these, so that you will be astonished. Indeed, just as the Father raises the dead and gives them life, so also the Son gives life to whomsoever he wishes. The Father judges no one, but has given all judgment to the Son, so that all may honour the Son just as they honour the Father. Anyone who does not honour the Son does not honour the Father who sent him. Absolutely, I'm telling you, anyone who hears my word and believes him who sent me has eternal life and does not come under judgment, but has passed from death to the life. Absolutely, I'm telling you, the hour is coming." Now, some of you will have "and is now here." That is an editorial comment or a redaction. I'm not saying it shouldn't be there. I'm just saying it's an editorial comment or a redaction. All right? "When the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live. For just as the Father has life in himself, so he has granted the Son also to have life in himself. And he who has given him authority to execute judgment, and he has given him authority to execute judgment because he is the Son of Man. Do not be astonished at this, for the hour is coming when all who are in their graves will hear his voice and will come out. Those who have done good to the resurrection of life, those who have done evil to the resurrection of judgment. I can do nothing on my own. As I hear, I judge. And my judgment is just because I seek to do not my own will, but the will of him who sent me. If I testify about myself, my testimony is not true. There is another who testifies on my behalf, and I know that his testimony to me is true. You sent messengers to John, and he testified to the truth. Not that I accept such human testimony, but I say these things so that you may be saved. He was a burning and shining lamp, and you were willing to rejoice for a while in his light. But I have a testimony greater than John's. The works the Father has given me to complete, the very works that I am doing, testify on my behalf that the Father has sent me, and the Father who sent me has himself testified on my behalf. You've never heard his voice or seen his form at any time, and you don't have his word abiding in you because you do not believe him whom he has sent. You search the scriptures because you think that in them you have eternal life. It is they that testify on my behalf. You refuse to come to me to have life.
I do not accept glory from human beings, but I know that you do not have the love of God in you. I have come in my Father's name, and you do not accept me. If another comes in his own name, him you will accept. How can you believe when you accept glory from one another and do not seek the glory that comes from the one who alone is God? Do not think that I will accuse you before the Father. Your accuser is Moses, on whom you have set your hope. Hey, if you believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote about me. But if you do not believe what he wrote, how will you believe what I say? And therein is a multitude of wisdom in that particular chapter. You were going to say something?
No,
you're just thinking. Yeah, okay. Over in Luke chapter 1, I want to just turn over to Luke for a minute before we actually get into the lecture in a purposeful way. Luke chapter 1, verses 1, 2, and 3 and 4, I guess. Luke says, "For as much as many have taken in hand to set forth in order a declaration of those things which are most certainly believed among us, even as they delivered them to us, which from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word, it seemed good to me also, having had perfect understanding in all things from the very first, to write unto you in order, most excellent Theophilus, that you might know the certainty of these things wherein you have been instructed." It is interesting. Luke says he was an eyewitness from the very beginning. And early church fathers talk about Luke being one of the 72 that was sent out by Yeshua in his ministry. And it's quite possible that that was the case. But certainly he says that he had a perfect understanding of all things from the very, very first. So Luke is scrupulous to record events historically as they unfold in the life of Yeshua. And you might say, what's this got to do with anything? Well, if you have a look very closely at Luke chapter 6 and verse 17, Luke chapter 6 and verse 17, it says, Yeshua came down with them, that's the disciple, and stood on a level place. Now please notice this. He stood on a level place. Some versions have it. He stood in the plain. Not a 747 or an Airbus, but a plain. And the company of his disciples and a great multitude of people from all Judea and Jerusalem from the sea coast of Tyre and Sidon came to hear him be healed of their diseases and so on and so forth. In fact, the text says thousands. So you've got Yeshua here on a plain, on a level area, and thousands of people are listening to him. Thousands of them. On the plain. And then he begins to talk about the Beatitudes. The Beatitudes. Now, unless Yeshua had the proclivity, the possibility, however remote, of having a prepared sermon, a prepared talk, which he gave everywhere he went, which the Gospels don't seem to indicate that that's the case, then we've got to look at the possibility that the reality was that he stood on a flat surface, on a plain, all right, on a level field when he gave the Beatitudes.
How did all those
multitudes
hear?
He had loudspeakers. Yeah. He had a very... I think Yeshua must have had a very profound...
Chest,
yes. He had lung power.
Have you heard Israeli speak?
Pardon?
Have you heard Israeli speak?
Yes, I've had a few of them here. And they bellow like stuck bulls. Yeah. And they're very loud. They're very loud. Yeah. Very loud and very abrupt.
Maybe it was the... acoustics of the area.
It might have been, but you know,
sure, just said he wouldn't know. But
he might be able to connect his voice through every ear, like he can change all language into one.
Yeah, but he was still human at the time. I don't think he was. That's possible, but I don't think it's in the realm of probability. But having said that, Matthew records the same event. Keep that in mind. But where does Matthew place Yeshua? On a mountaintop. On a mountaintop. Now, Matthew, according to Redemptorist scholar Peter Ellis, Matthew, he says, was a scholar of the highest order who had at his command a considerable knowledge of rabbinic law and teaching expertise. He also had a great respect for Moses, a passionate interest in the interpretation and fulfillment of the law and the prophets, and an extensive knowledge of the Hebrew scriptures. He knows how to formulate questions in a rabbinic manner. He exhibits a considerable understanding of the Haggadic and apocalyptic literature. And he understands the Pharisees as perhaps only a former Pharisee like Paul or himself could understand them. This is Matthew, right? A scholar in his own right. And he says Matthew's hostility reflects the contemporary age and audience at the occasion of his writing. And clearly there is more than a little bit of tension when you read Matthew. I mean, we're in John now, and I'm talking about Matthew. There's tension between Yeshua's disciples, certain, and the Pharisees, and Yeshua himself and the Pharisees. We've got to accept that as a given. There is tension. And Matthew records a very strained relationship between religious leaders and himself. No doubt about that. And they are at every turn people to be fought, countered, argued against, and refuted. And this is what Yeshua does. He's very rarely polite when it comes to the Pharisees. Very rarely polite. And you don't find any interaction with the Sadducees at all. He says, in fact, to his disciples, the leaven of the Sadducees, you know, steer clear of them. He said, they're ignorant. They're grossly ignorant people. So you find very little said about the Sadducees. But this attitude that Matthew shows gives us an idea that when he wrote it, it was very early in the Messianic period, an exceptionally early period in the history of the Messianic movement. Matthew takes Yeshua and turns him into the new Moses. No doubt about that. Yeshua has a new Moses. Yeshua is the new Moses. And it is rather interesting that the early Messianists, which is what the Christians were called by Josephus Flavius, they took the New Testament corpus and they created a new Torah. Up on the whiteboard here, you'll see Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Luke 2. Luke 2, of course, is the Acts of the Holy Spirit, sometimes called the Acts of the Apostles, which it wasn't, and couldn't be. It's the Acts of the Holy Spirit, Luke 2. The early Christians took Matthew and said, that is Genesis. Mark equaled Exodus. Luke, Leviticus, John, Numbers, and Luke 2, or the Acts of the Holy Spirit, was Deuteronomy. It is rather interesting, because people don't do this anymore. If you want to use a whole day, and you've got a computer, go and Google each of those books and put, for instance, Matthew and Genesis contents. You will find, as you go through these five books, basically the same arguments, the same tension, the same areas of reference that you will find in each of the Torah volumes. Rather interesting. And of course, the early church fathers knew what they were talking about. They read those things and they looked at the New Testament and they came to that conclusion. They came to that conclusion because it's real. It's the only conclusion you can come to. And this shows us that in the early Messianic period, there was a withdrawal, you might call it, from Mosaic Sinai thinking into something new and profound. No doubt about that. You'll be surprised when you compare Matthew with Genesis. Just
what there is in similarity. Mark with Exodus, oh, very interesting stories that he has, and keep an eye open for the main themes of each of the scrolls of the Torah, and you'll see what I'm getting at. You'll notice up here too, but the Gospel of Matthew is actually the Gospel of James, and a lot of people recognise this, and certainly the Gospel of Mark is the Gospel of Peter. Mark was Peter's amanuensis or secretary, and so he was simply giving Peter's account of the life of the Messiah. Got to keep that in mind, so that it helps us to not only broaden our views on the scripture, but helps us to authenticate where the original writers were coming from. Now, I've previously written this. Recall that to the priestly caste, the Levites, God gave the preservation of the Torah. And you'll find that in Deuteronomy 31, verse 9. Don't bother going there, just make a mental note on paper. And Mashiach came first and foremost to the Jews, not the Gentiles, by his own admission. Matthew 15, 24. Matthew 10, verse 5 and 6. Rav Shaul made the point that the gospel was always to go first to the Jews and followed then to the Gentiles. You'll find that all the way through Romans, and even in the Acts, you'll find the same thing. The procedure occurs where the Jews are approached first, and then when they reject, it goes to the Gentiles. Intriguingly, there continues to remain a major emphasis by Matthew on the emphatic importance of the very existence of Torah. For Matthew Levy has presented to us a gospel in five primary divisions or sections, which will follow the flow of the original Torah of Moses with its five books. It may well be the case that Matthew is the amanuensis, or secretary of James, the brother of the Lord, and the alternative high priest of Jerusalem. If this is the case, and it may well be, then the Gospel of Matthew is really the Gospel of James, just as the Gospel of Mark is actually Peter's Gospel. Whatever the case, for his own circle of faith, Matthew has virtually created a complementary Torah, the contents of which exemplify the Lord Yeshua as the fulfillment of its purpose in existence. Now, I wrote that blurb in the series I did on Matthew. Okay, Matthew. Now, what I want you to do, just to refresh your memory here, is have a look at Matthew 1, verse 1, and make a note in your Bible, first section. So where you see Matthew 1, verse 1, you put a little note, first section. And then if you go through to chapter 7 and look at verse 28, Matthew 1, 1 starts with, a record of the genealogy of Yeshua, the Messiah, the son of David. And then, 7, verse 28. And you'll notice that Matthew 7, verse 28 ends with these words, when Yeshua has finished saying these things. All right? This is Matthew chapter 1, verse 1, right through to 7, verse 28. It ends with, when Yeshua has finished saying these things. I want you to note that. Then have a look at Matthew chapter 8 and verse 1. Because Matthew chapter 8 and verse 1 is the beginning of the second section. The second section. It begins with, when he came down from the mountainside. Now, in chapter 11 and verse 1, chapter 11 and verse 1, it concludes with, after Yeshua had finished instructing his 12 disciples. Okay, please notice, that's the second section. It concludes with, after Yeshua had finished. Exactly as the first section, which says, when Yeshua has finished saying these things. Okay, now, Matthew 11, verse 2, begins the third section. Matthew 11, verse 2, begins the third section. And it goes all the way through to 13, verse 53. Matthew 13, verse 53. It begins, in fact, with when John heard in prison what Messiah was accomplishing. That's how it begins in Matthew 11, 2. All the way through to 13, 53, ending with when Yeshua had finished these parables. Okay, so there's the third section. And notice what he's doing here. He's literally telling us, this is the end of a section. This is the end of a section. This is the end of a section. Now have a look at Matthew 13, verse 54. Some of you will know this from previous lectures, but I'm just rehashing. Matthew 13, verse 54, begins with coming to his community, blah, blah, blah. And it goes through to 19, verse 1. And that's the fourth section. That's the fourth section. Because it ends with, when Yeshua had finished his sayings, all right, please notice this. It's coming out all the way through. I don't know how people haven't seen this. Now, look at Matthew 19, verse 3. This is the fifth section. Matthew 19, verse 3. It goes right through to the end of the book of Matthew, chapter 28, verse 20. It begins in Matthew 19, 3, with some Pharisees came to him to test him. And it ends with teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you, and certainly I am with you always to the very conclusion of the age. 28, verse 20. The very end of Matthew. So the very first section parallels Genesis, the five divisions of Matthew and the Torah. So the very first division parallels Genesis. And you will find things relating to Genesis. You sit down and have a good look at it. And the second section relates to Exodus. And you'll find things there about Exodus. The third section is Leviticus. And it refers to sacrifice and all that kind of stuff. And then, of course, if you come over to the fourth, you find Numbers. It relates to it. And the final section is all about Deuteronomy and what was included in the book of Deuteronomy. So the five sections that Matthew has presented to us orients around the Torah. A new Torah, as a matter of fact. Now, he's not negating the old Torah. He's just saying, hey, we've got one especially designed for you Messianic believers. That's what he's saying. And I find this very, very intriguing. He finishes all the time, each section, after Yeshua had finished these sayings, after Yeshua had finished speaking, after Yeshua had said, you'll find it all the way through. And the fact that there is a pattern that emerges excites me. I think this is very, very, very interesting. Because Matthew follows Genesis, particularly, in relation to Gentiles. And you know what? All the way through Genesis, it's all about the Gentiles. And all the way through Genesis, they're innocent. You notice that? They're innocent. Now, some people in Genesis who are Gentiles are not they're not innocent. And the rabbis would be pointing the finger and saying, you know, look at these women particularly. They did this, they did this, they did this. But Yeshua was reversing the condemnation of the law and giving people salvation and life. And so what Matthew is doing is clearly emphasizing the Gentiles also as innocents, the same as Genesis, and standing them in marked demarcation to the self-righteous religious leaders. I find this intriguing. Matthew, who should be staunch, you know, he's a Levite. Bang, bang, bang. No, he's showing, hey, the Gentiles. Accept the Gentiles. Showing when Matthew was written, it was written primarily at the time when Paul was going out evangelizing the Gentiles and was receiving rabbinic rejection because of it. And Paul says, no, I'm going first to the Jews and then to the Gentiles. I'm going to give all you Jews an opportunity first, but if you don't want to take it, I'm turning to the Gentiles. All the way through Matthew, this is found out. And in fact, if you look at Matthew 1, verse 3, Matthew chapter 1 and verse 3, you're saying, what's this got to do with John? I'll come to that in a second. But Matthew chapter 1 and verse 3, there's a woman mentioned. A Gentile mentioned in it. Well, not a Gentile, she's a lady with a bit of a past. She's called Tamar, or Tamar. And then, if you look at verse 5, you will find Rahab. You will find her. And she had a bit of a past as well. And if you look at verse 6, Eva?
Ruth?
Oh, Ruth. I'm just turning. Verse 5. Yeah. Ruth, yep. You can say, she didn't have a past. She was all right. No, she wasn't. She is mentioned as having a very interesting way of announcing a desire to become somebody's bride. She had, right? So, well, you said it. And down in verse 6, the Bathsheba was mentioned. But you know what? Matthew was so strict as a Levite, he said, I'm not even going to mention a name. So he says, she of Urias. She of Urias. And of course, Matthew, when he's writing all this, he's talking about these women, but he's got in mind the fact that Miriam, the mother of Yeshua, also was tainted as far as the rabbis were concerned. The innuendo all Yeshua's life, that, you know, you were not born of Cornea. And even to this day, this innuendo, this contempt, carries through in current rabbinic defamations. But here, Matthew is interested in Gentiles, and Matthew is certainly emphasizing their innocence. In fact, he even talks about the Magi, who come to the birth, not the birth, but when Yeshua was about 2 years old, the Magi come and visit, and they were Gentiles, astrologers, and they came. So Matthew gives them a big tick. And then, of course, you've got the pagan Roman Gentile centurion, whose faith was unparalleled in all Israel. That's in Matthew. And if you read long enough, you'll find a Canaanite woman, a Syro-Phoenician, and she's coming saying, you know, Lord, Lord, heal my child. She has unwavering total trust in Yeshua. And then there's the procurator, the Roman procurator, Pontius Pilatus, and his wife, who say, we're innocent of the blood of this man. You know, she has a dream, his wife has a dream, and I'm telling you now, the Pontius Pilate listened to his wife. And he and let's not forget also, ultimately, the Roman at the bloody tree of Golgotha, at the very time when he's hearing Yeshua going through his death rattles, the very time he starts going through the death rattles, he sees the lintel over the temple collapse and the great curtain torn in two right at that time. And the Gentile pagan Roman says, truly this was a son of the gods. Right, so there you've got Matthew listing all these evidences of Gentile innocence all the way through, and I get quickened in my spirit when I read this kind of thing, and you know, it doesn't stop there. At the very end of the book of Matthew, you've got Yeshua himself saying to his apostles, "Get out there into the pagan Gentile world, exalt my name out there, teaching them whatever Yeshua has commanded." Okay, this is what he's saying. That's my take on Matthew. But in this light, see now how John takes Matthew's lead and pursues his theological line of thought that he's had from the very, very beginning. John initially flows more in the wake of Matthew's steps than being swept along in the tide, you might say, of Luke's literalism. Okay? Because, let's face it, Matthew does stretch reality a little bit. Because, if you remember, it is Pontius Pilate who picks up a bowl of water and washes his hands, says, I'm innocent of the blood of this man. That's what you call apologetic. He never did that. He hated the Jews. He wanted them all exterminated. He said his Romans on maybe time he could get an opportunity. That was a Jewish custom. He would not have been doing something like that. That would have been appeasing the Jews. Forget it. Matthew is simply saying he's washing his hands. This was his way of getting at the Pharisees and saying, you know what? He washed his hands in a bowl, declaring his innocence. Now, I don't believe that actually happened. I believe it was simply Matthew's way of dramatizing what occurred at the time of the crucifixion. Having said that, I don't see that as a lie, as I'm showing you in the Gospel of John. John is taking the events in the life of Yeshua and rearranging them to form his own theology. And Matthew's doing a little bit of that as well. But Luke is frank, and he is legitimate. I've shown you that. But John goes further than this Matthean theme. He goes further than Matthew ever dreamt, because he takes Yeshua and he sees him not so much as a new Moses, but as a new Joshua. And I'm going to come to that in a second. But he will, the new Joshua, according to John, is going to lead people out of where they are in this death constellating life, like contradiction in terms of it. He's going to lead them into the promised land, a new Sabbath rest. Well, that's where John's heading in the third sign, while the other undeserving individuals are looked upon as Canaanites, not as Jews, but as spiritual Canaanites, and they're left out. They can't progress into the Sabbath rest of the Messianic landscape. They can't. They're trapped. They're trapped in their own intransigence. And more evil bunch of people I don't think we could ever have hoped to find.
It isn't much the same as today, isn't it? The religious people are trapped.
Well, I think so. Yeah. And I think if Yeshua had come today, the same thing would have happened.
Yeah. Because people don't want to hear.
Well, people don't want to be free.
Correct. That's right.
They don't want to be free. The number of people... When I left the synagogue and joined FEBC, I went around teaching and preaching, the number of people that would come to me and ask, you know, what do you advise to toothpaste? Why? Because they want to be enslaved. This man knows better than me. What toothpaste should I use? I have had some of the weirdest questions put to me. Nothing about eternal life. No, but how should I live? You've only got to go up to Word Bookshop up at Southport. Southport? Yeah, Southport, yeah. Up the coast. And look at the Talmud, Christian Talmud. Thousands of volumes on how to live. Isn't this one good enough? Isn't the Bible good enough? We've got all these books, all these tapes, all these CDs, all...
But it's the same in Judaism.
Look, it's worse than Judaism.
They're scholars rather than learning from the Word. Enough, it's what the scholars...
I understand that, but it's worse than the Jews ever did. They had...
Because every Tom, Dick and Harry's putting something on paper.
They at least had people who were authorities.
Yes.
This is self-promotion, most of it.
Of course it is. Of course it is. I had somebody only this week ring me up and say, and some of you will know who I'm talking about, he said, have you heard of Benny Hinn? I said, yeah. He said, yeah, great preacher. I started biting my nails, a form of self-mutilation. It was either that or get angry.
Cut yourself.
Start to see something psychologically out of this world. Laurel just said before, you know, and I agree with it, people don't want to be free.
No.
I gave a whole lecture recently about how we will go to any length to stay enslaved.
Because they're not accountable then.
Of course they're not accountable. And they're free.
The preachers are accountable.
Yeah. It's peculiar.
And they have the responsibility then.
It's peculiar.
Well, it's in the hands of the heart. Says some things are wrong. I agree.
Yeah, of course.
But he hasn't got the whole truth there. It's just botched up because he hasn't bothered to listen any further.
No, he hasn't.
Than what he thinks he knows everything.
But he's just one. They're all the others. Yeah. All the televangelists. I don't watch him. I can't watch him anymore.
No, make you feel sick.
I get my stomach churns, yeah.
That's the old man.
Of course it's the old man.
Yeah, it is the old man.
It is. And the people who just hang off his thing for miracles, signs and wonders.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, how about the word of God that transforms you?
It's back to the wrong man.
No, they don't want that.
Their focus is on the wrong man.
They just want miracles and signs and wonders.
And not personal.
I like miracles.
Relationship.
I like signs. I like wonders. But the reverend just said, there's no personal relationship in there. That's exactly right. When Yeshua
and
comes back...
personal accountability to God and to your relationship with him and everything counting toward that, not what somebody else has to say about that.
In Matthew chapter 7, Yeshua comes... He's talking about people who come to him at the end of the age and they're all going, Lord, 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 Lordy, 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 Miss Claudia. They all come to him. But the... And he's saying, why do you call me Lord and don't do what I'm saying? You know, he says, I don't even know you. Please note, he doesn't say, I knew you once, but you fell away. He doesn't say that. He says, I've never known you. But they're calling him Lord. And what are they doing? Major signs, miracles and wonders. but they are devoid of the Spirit of God, and there's no relationship. That's what's missing. The relationship, as you just pointed out, you pointed out, the relationship does not exist. They had this head knowledge, and only that to a degree, yes.
Chasing the prophet.
It's
chasing the prophet.
Chasing the prophet. What is
true. Remember the life of Brian? Or his God, you know?
They want God's natural figures and make everything perfect for them.
You know what? I would love it if God did that.
No, it would be.
I would enjoy it if God just snapped his fingers and it was thus. It often isn't. And we go through agony and agony and agony before God actually then begins. You said it a minute ago, Les Moon, where God will, you know, suddenly out of nowhere, he'll charge in, you know, there it is. But it doesn't come in the way you expected, number one, and number two, it doesn't come when you want it.
Because all you know is your world at that time, whereas God's creating, even before you've uttered the prayer, God's already been creating all this other scenario to bring about the situation that you're praying about. You're just falling in with his plan anyway.
That's exactly right. And he's known from all eternity that moment. And what we've got to do sometimes is when the pressure comes on, we're going to sit back and go... Because when the pressure comes on, you can either lose sight of God, or you can be so magnified in your view of God. It's like one or the other. This week I found, before I received a particular email that I shared with some of you, I was sort of down, and something said, take a step back. And as I did, I began to think of that statement, the very hairs of your head are all numbered. And if God knows us so intimately that he knows how many hairs we have on our head, instantaneously, without even thought, and God's not autistic, but autistic people can do things like that too, but be that as it may, we're all in the image of God. I admit, I don't know why I mentioned that. But we're all in God. But that is interesting. Think about that. The fact that God, as soon as he knows you, he knows everything about you, every single thing. I had a lady, Les Moon remembers this, a lady that came here once, and she said, I don't pray about intimate things because, God might see what I'm really like. And I'm thinking, what? He already knows what you're really like. This is the 21st century, and you get comments like that come out from the medieval period, and you sort of wonder, where's your head? Where have you been hiding all these years?
God knows everything about everyone.
Absolutely.
So
he knows the heart of man. He knows that the prayers that are being answered are the ones down here, okay, in the subconscious.
I think that's the whole point.
Well, our conscious talks faith down here, the reality exists, where it's a big black monster inside.
That he knows the heart of people, and those people who go like to Benny Hinn and all these people, and let's face it, they're meeting these people's needs because that's where their heart
that's where
is.
Their heart
that's,
is.
That's what they're understanding. But they don't want to go any further because they're happy.
I said a second ago, that's the old man, that's the flesh.
That's where the whole story ends. But you've always got to be looking. And if there's
gotta go deep, baby, go real deep.
But if you're really after God, he'll lead you into the next phase that he's got by some way of connecting you with the next step up. People aren't looking for it. They're happy where they are.
Well, they are. And they're happy for you to take responsibility for them.
Yeah. And if you try to help them and they won't hear you, you can't do anything but what the Lord says and not cast your will before them and move on to somebody else. But it's very hard to get people to get out of that level they're at.
It is difficult because they're stuck there because of their upbringing, their rental.
Somebody's meeting their need where they are, and they get so wrapped up in that person rather than what's up.
Yes, yes.
That's exactly right.
I said before, they've got their eyes on the wrong man.
Well, you know.
Or the wrong woman, whatever. Yeah.
As I said earlier, you know, they used to ask me about toothpaste or what, you know, vitamins should they have or what this. Do your own research.
And what positions they can have in bed with
yes,
their husband.
That was a beauty. That was a ding dong, that one. Among the choice of words there. But this lady came up and asked me, you know, what positions are okay in sex with your husband?
Google it up.
And that was in an Anglican church.
Cowboy book.
Of all things. And I looked at it with. I just broke into a big smile because I just thought, what do I do here? Am I going to get embarrassed or am I going to be, you know? I said, what turns you on? You know? Well, she didn't want that response.
The Apostle Paul says nothing defiles the marriage bed.
That's right.
But you couldn't say that to everybody.
No.
Because that would be giving them license for lasciviousness.
Of course. Blood on the spurs. All right. Look, that and the whip. This is ridiculous. Look, some people need to just grow up.
Some people need to submit to their Lord more than they submit.
Submit to the Lord, don't talk to this turkey. Talk to God. Talk to God. The name Yeshua is very similar to Joshua. Getting back on track. Where was I? Okay. Very similar because, you know, people think, you know, there's no difference at all between the names Joshua and Yeshua.
Mm.
But Yeshua, I hasten to point out to these people, is an abbreviation of Yehoshua. And it's translated and transliterated into English as Joshua. But it's not the same as Yeshua. It's very similar, that is true. And, of course, the similarity is brought out in the circular letter addressed to the Hebrews, which may have originally been dispatched to remnants of the remaining Qumran sectarians who were floundering at that time with their faith in Yeshua, because, you know, the Romans were moving against the state of Israel and the temple was going to be destroyed and all of that. And the letter to the Hebrews is written in such a way the author is saying, you know what, a Sabbath day remains for the people of God. A Sabbatismos remains for the people of God. And, of course, it's not negating seventh-day Sabbath from the fourth commandment, but it's saying, see the bigger picture. See the bigger picture. We're about to enter eternity. And the Sabbath rest of the fourth commandment is to be found in Yeshua. And indeed, it highlights this motif against the backdrop of the special meaning of the Sabbath day. That eternity is due right at that time, is undeniable. You read the letter to the Hebrews and you get the impression Yeshua is coming back now.
Yeah.
It says he stands. James said the same thing. He stands. Well, it means Yeshua's been sitting for a long time. Now he's up. If he's up, he's going to get on the horse. If he's going to get on the horse, he's going to draw the sword. If he draws the sword, the portal is going to open between the heavens and the earth. And in that wormhole, Yeshua's coming through with multiple billions of flying saucers. Look out, people. Okay? He's on his way. But that didn't happen. It didn't happen. But indeed, The use of the Sabbath day as a symbol of eternity is seen even in Genesis chapter 2. In fact, if you look at Genesis chapter 2, verses 1, 2, and 3, you will find something missing. And what is missing is the repetitious statement by Moses from Genesis 1. At the end of each of the days of creation, when God finishes, it says, "And the end of and the evening and the morning were day one. And a little bit further, the evening and the morning were day two. And a little bit further, the evening and the morning were day three." It's in Genesis chapter 1, verse 5, 8, 13, 19, 23, and 31. You will find at the end of each day, it says, "And the evening and the morning were day blah blah." But when you come to the Sabbath day, God creates the Sabbath day. He rests upon it. He infuses it with his spirit, his personality, his presence, his power, all the things that are good and enriching and delightful and lovely and wonderful. He puts all that into the Sabbath day. Then he goes on with something else because it's still in existence. The evening and the morning were not the seventh day or day seven.
it's absent, doesn't, because the whole concept is of the quality of eternity, is locked into the Sabbath day in a formidable way, into the rest of God. It's locked in there. And those who seek to remove it, those who seek to argue against it, those who seek to unlock it even, are under a terrible and an abiding curse, in my opinion. In my opinion. Because even the carnal churches of this world recognize that the Sabbath is the seventh day of the week, not Sunday. You were going to say something?
Yeah, it's interesting that it's separated.
Yes, separate.
Separate.
Yeah, it is. Totally. Totally. So, Yeshua seeks to perform this special miracle. Okay, with a bloke that's 38 years on the mat, literally on the mat, on the Sabbath day. And Yeshua knew precisely what the reaction of the new Canaanites, okay, what the new Canaanites was going to be when he stated, "Will you be made whole?" People were milling around Yeshua everywhere he went. He had crowds, and when he uttered those immortal words, he did so in the hearing of the lawyers, the scribes, the Pharisees, the Herodians. And when he said, "Will you be made whole?" He got everyone's attention. He got everyone's attention because he took the bull by the horns. He set it up. It was almost like Job chapter 1, where God sets up Hasatan. He says, "Oh, what are you doing here?" And he says, "Oh, I've just been flying around, circling the earth. Oh, have you considered my servant Job?" And off it goes, and running. So he would have made, that would have been a full-on frontal assault to those listening nearby. And he knew they would interpret his actions in a very negative way. No doubt about that. And they would have actions that would have disturbing consequences. And I'm going to show you what's written between the lines and what's not written between the lines, but which is in John chapter 5. I'll show you in a second. But based on everything that's gone before in my previous 15 lectures on this subject, John also was well aware of exactly what he was intending to convey in his writing of this particular narrative, and he gives no apologies forthcoming for doing so. So, Yeshua follows up the question to the paralytic of 38 long and torturous years with the command, "Get up, stand up, take up your bed, and walk, and keep on walking." Now this is interesting, because his command sent shockwaves through those who surrounded him, the spectators. There are rabbis today who object that the New Testament, they say, is complete, replete, I should say, with mammoth exaggerations and misinterpretations when it comes to describing the Second Temple period. And I take real exception to their objections, because I know the Second Temple period probably better than they know it. And if they know it better than me, they're covering things up. And they have no qualms about doing so. They have no qualms. According to Jewish anti-missionaries, religious authorities of the mid to late Second Temple period would never have had a prohibition of healing on the Sabbath and or carrying your bed on the Sabbath day, and that these facts alone establish the New Testament as untrustworthy. All right? Well, and
man's interpretation.
Yeah. Well, look, I've got to give them this. Condescending to some extent, but I'll give them this. The laws against carrying burdens on the Sabbath day do not apply to possessions carried inside your home. Because if you look at the commandments about the Sabbath very carefully, you'll find that if you are within the walls of Jerusalem, hence the walls within your home, take it to that extent, you can carry anything you want. I can pick up Gladys if I'm excited and go, "Come on, we're going to bed." Okay. and struggle her up, or she can pick me up. Good luck. And whatever. It's, or I can, to this lectin, I can pick that up today and bring it in. I haven't broken the Sabbath. Yes?
I want to say, if I walked into a synagogue with a bag over my shoulder that had my medicine in it, just so I had, that, I had to have that medicine to survive.
Sure.
I walked in through the door, so I'd been up the street, something carrying on my arm, and came into the shul and sat down. Everyone would be looking at me. And I would get a few words about it, about carrying something, even though it's life-threatening medicine, which I'm allowed to carry because that supersedes every Sabbath law, but they don't know that. And after all, I would have said, this is full of my medicine, I have to carry it in order to live. They'd shut their mouths, but they'd all be annoyed because they, you know, oh, you're breaking the Sabbath here. There's no contradiction in what's written in the New Testament. Of course, he's walking around with a mat and they've all scolded him.
Yeah, exactly.
They didn't know that he had just... You know, that he'd just been living on it, were unable to walk. But they still would have been upset because they called someone out and judged them.
Don't
you hate that? When you really think something and something's actually no, you're wrong.
It's too ritual.
Just remember. Just remember. Yeah, but just remember. The synagogues today, collectively, I'm not talking about the Hasid, I'm talking about the synagogues today, Orthodox, Reform, and so on, are very much of the ancient Pharisaic school, but not the school of Hillel. I'm going to come to that in a second. Yes, so, you know, walls, within walls, which are holy, it's okay to do those things. And again, what Amos is talking about is going to prove my point in a minute about the Pharisaic school and which school it is. Because even today, you can observe in the old city of Jerusalem, Jews carrying burdens around. You can watch them. And it was permissible in the first century to do it in Jerusalem, and it's permissible even today in the old city. And there's even YouTube videos which show the Jews carrying Bibles around, carrying things around, inside the old city walls. I find this fascinating because it literally crucifies, if I can use that term, rabbinic authorities today who speak otherwise about carrying a burden. So,
woman's handbag is.
Well, yeah.
Tend to go that's half a suitcase, half a
glove. You know, especially the things that are in it. But you see, this argument does not include, this argument by the Jews, the Orthodox particularly, does not include the various first century sectarian regulations about the Sabbath day, hear me, the various sectarian regulations about the Sabbath day and what was or was not permitted during its observance. In fact, Josephus, in his War of the Jews, accounts that the Essenes, as a prime example, observed the Shabbat far more rigorously and strictly than other Jews in his day. In fact, in his exact words, quote, they are stricter than any of the other of the Jews in resting from their labours on the seventh day. For they not only get their food ready the day before, well, you know, the preparation day was given to you so you could prepare it all ahead of time. That's the commandment, and yet the Essenes were keeping it to such a degree that they wouldn't prepare anything on the Sabbath. Now, we know that Yeshua, at one stage, turned up on the Sabbath at a particular house with a whole bunch of his disciples. How many? I don't know how many, but quite a lot. And the woman who was there at the house that he arrived at prepared on the Sabbath, out of hospitality, food. And they had a party. Alright? Now, it is interesting. He says, they not only get their food ready the day before, that they may not be obliged to kindle a fire on that day. Now, his admission is that while the Essenes wouldn't light a fire on the Sabbath day, other Jews would not have a problem with lighting a fire. That's what he's saying. Yet today, you can't even turn a switch on. Okay? If you're a Jew, on the Sabbath day, you can have food already in the oven, and the oven's simply turned off just before Shabbat comes so that everything remains. Or even leave it on.
Doesn't that bring on a burden then?
Of course it is.
But then see, they would do what we do when we trust God, that he will provide the provision because we're keeping the commandment.
Yeah, but you imagine the horror when they get their electricity bills. Yeah, because they only had one kitchen, they had two kitchens. All right. So he says they may not be obliged to kindle a fire on that day, but that they will not remove any vessel out of its place. In other words, if you wanted a drink, no, that's weird. That's what the Essenes would do. They treated it in such a way that they would not move any vessel out of its place. It says, nor work their bowels thereon. Work their bowels.
Just don't get out of bed.
They usually didn't. So, you know, this shows where they were. They were so rigidly strict. I'll tell you what the so-called Essenes today that are around claiming to be Essenes, they don't do that.
What
did
they do?
They were really bound up.
They were really bound up. They really were. Can you imagine something, you know, walking around like this if you're in a...
We have at times.
Well, not for religious reasons. Okay.
So, wouldn't
it be
great to
be uncomfortable?
Of course.
Yeah.
The rest of God is gone. Okay, and these are the critics going, yeah, just heal the person on the Sabbath day and tell him to pick up his mat. You're not a very nice person, Yeshua. Look, when Yeshua's question, were Yeshua's critics that day previously influenced by, or were they representatives from, or presently constituted as, those of the extreme Essene faith? Or were they not? Were they actually scribes and Pharisees with their nitpicking arduous rules and petty regulations? Or even worse, were they Sadducees? So, you know, when the Jews turn around today and say it was not permissible to carry a burden on the Sabbath day such as a bed, I've already shown you that it was permissible, but that certain sects said no. So let's narrow it right down a little bit to that. Whatever the answer in relation to this incident, one must be very cautious about being too disparaging when it comes to the Pharisees or other sects in the first century, because in their interpretation of Sabbath issues and requirements, because the Sabbath commandment was, and still is, in the fourth commandment in Exodus chapter 20 and Deuteronomy chapter 5, not qualified. So you can't really point the finger at the Jews back then, because the commandment itself is deficient. It's deficient. It tells us work is forbidden, but it doesn't then qualify or clarify what is meant by work. So the Pharisees and Sadducees and others had to sit back and say, well, work means this. Now I take my hat off too, because they did not want to break the commandment. They said, well, the commandment doesn't tell us. Remember Moses had this problem. The angels of God, you see, were deficient in their giving of the law. They were deficient. They didn't qualify things. They didn't qualify. Remember in Job 4 verse 18, where God says, to which of my angels have I not charged with stupidity? All right? So here were the angels of God at Sinai. They didn't clarify and qualify the Ten Commandments, and the fourth commandment doesn't tell you what work is. They're saying, do not work on this day. What is work? Oh, I forgot to mention that.
Obviously picking up sticks for one.
Well, let me talk about that in Numbers. The other bloke goes around, he picks up sticks. Now, if you look carefully, the whole section that it's in is all about, and I have proven this since we've talked, for my own sake, has to do with the furnaces and the fires of the tabernacle. Because it was God's work, this fellow said, well, everybody else is resting, but I'm going to go out there and show them how righteous I am. I'm going to fuel the fire. So he went around picking up sticks. The people saw him doing it, and they brought him to Moses, and they said, you know, what do we do with this fellow? And Moses says, I don't know, the commandment hasn't said. I'll talk to God. So he talks to God. And God says, take him out and kill him. Kill the bum. Now, it's not in those words, but it's that same intent. He said, get rid of him. Why? Because this fellow was self-righteously trying to create works for salvation, work for the tabernacle. Everyone else is at rest, but I am doing the right thing. We've had people here who would override the commandment of God in relation to myself to make decisions that only I can make and trample all over what I have created over years and years and years because they feel righteously called by God to do this. You know who I'm talking about. And God removed that man. And I'll tell you what, he's still being removed from himself now. Tragic. Tragic. Yeah, Glenys shakes her head and shivers. I would not want to be that man. But he overrode an administrative decision that I'd made.
Bombastically.
And yes, I won't go.
Not in small measure.
Total, complete. I couldn't believe it. Yeah. So, so God said to them, go and kill him, get rid of him. So.
But he also says that so that this kind of attitude basically will be.
Yeah, stop it now. Stop it before it starts.
Yeah.
So, Barbara Sewling, in her 1975 work called More Wacky Laws, mentioned on the site Bible.org, gives a list of regulations which are still on the books in some places in the USA in 2015. Now, if we looked at some of our legislation in Australia, we would find some very strange laws and regulations still on our law books. In fact, New South Wales, which is the most over-regulated state in the world, get that, in the world, we have more regulations and statutes and ordinances in New South Wales than any other place on earth. Here we are, pointing the finger back there at the Pharisees and Sadducees and all the others and saying, oh, that stupid law. No, wait a minute. Look, let me list a few of these so-called wacky laws this woman mentions. And none of these even take into consideration the so-called blue laws in America. Right? Keep that right out of the equation because some of them are pretty amazing. The Jews of the Second Temple period are really in good company because here are some of the laws. In Pennsylvania, this is 2015. In Pennsylvania, the penalty for cursing is 45 cents. That's the fine you get, 45 cents. But if God is mentioned in the curse, the fine is 67 cents. Now, that's still on the books. In Utah, the law requires that daylight be seen between two dancing partners. So if you're dancing, you've got to have sunlight between. I guess that means at nightfall, there's no dancing at all.
That's
archaic, but it's there. In San Francisco, you are not permitted to carry a basket suspended from a pole. It is unlawful for goldfish to ride on a Seattle, Washington bus unless they lie still.
Somebody had a live catch once upon a time.
Obviously. Yeah. Michigan law once required taking a census of bees every winter.
Oh.
In Natchez, Mississippi.
That's interesting, though. Mm. That is interesting. Yeah, if you think about it, that's got a reason.
There is, yeah. In Mississippi, it is against the law for elephants to drink beer. I mean, you see, we point the finger at the Jews in the Second Temple period.
Some circus has been doing that, and someone's going, you can't do this to this poor thing.
An old Hollywood, California ordinance forbids driving more than 2,000 sheep down Hollywood Boulevard at one time.
It's like kangaroos down George Street, isn't it?
In Muncie, Indiana, you cannot bring fishing tackle into a cemetery. I look at that statute and think, uh-oh. Okay. The California Penal Code prohibits the shooting of any animal except a whale from an automobile.
Good luck with that.
But these are still on the books. And I'm sure, as I said, we would also have certain laws still on our books. In Kansas City, Missouri.
Especially with the wild gunning that goes on. It has gone on.
Oh, thank goodness, exactly.
It's my whale, I got it. I was about to put my spear into it. No, I shot it in the head first, it's mine.
I'm a marine biologist. Yeah, you can see Seinfeld's episode. Yeah, in Kansas City, Missouri, children are prohibited by law from buying cap pistols. However, the law does not restrict them buying shotguns.
Oh.
A Minnesota law requires that men's and women's underwear not be hung on the same clothesline at the same time. And in Joliet, Illinois, women are not allowed to try on more than 6 dresses in one store. So you got all these laws, rules and regulations of man, you know, and they're still on the books in 2015. But getting back to the question of the Sabbath criticism by certain religious leaders in John chapter 5, recall there were essentially 2 schools of Pharisaic doctrine during this period. One founded by a gentleman called Hillel, the other by Shammai. All right. Now, Hillel was always looking, in fact, he said, you know, much the same thing as Yeshua, whatever you don't want done to you, don't do to others. You know, and Hillel was always looking upon the sincere heart. Hillel was a lovely man. He lived about 50 years before Yeshua. And he was looking at the spirit of the law way back then. And but the other, Shammai, was a realist. He took a harsher approach to life. And to grant some appreciative comparison between the two, on one occasion, Hillel advocated what he called a sacred lie. He advocated a sacred lie in the case of an impoverished orphan bride on her wedding day so that she could feel beautiful for once. Right? You can see her all dressed up in a plain Jane or whatever, and she's dressed up in all of this, and she feels beautiful. But Shammai says, no, she should be told the harsh truth about herself and her appearance, because that's righteous. So you see the tension between Hillel and Shammai. I find this interesting because when you look at Hillel and Yeshua, you find similarity in doctrines. It's interesting, similarity. In fact, in Matthew 12:7, I've got up here, the Pharisaic schools consisted of Hillel and Shammai, and I give the reference here. And you look at that and go, it doesn't say anything about Hillel and Shammai. Well, you have a look at it. Matthew 12:7. What does Yeshua say? I will have mercy. There's Hillel. And not sacrifice. There's Shammai. And that's what he's saying. I will follow Hillel on most things, and I will ignore Shammai on the other. That's what Yeshua is really saying. And so, who were the ones that criticized Yeshua so heavily for healing a man on the Sabbath and telling him to carry his bed? They were not from the school of Hillel. They were from Shammai. In fact, one sectarian author has said the bed as mukzah, or mukzah, an object one does not intend to use during the Sabbath after the healing, thereby forbidden to be moved. That's how the Shammaiite Pharisees interpreted things. But Yeshua followed Hillel, and he said that the prohibition of mukzah does not apply where the state developed after beginning of the Sabbath. I find when you get into the Talmud statements, they begin to become self-revelatory for the period that they emerged in the Second Temple. So all rabbis know well that the keeping of the Sabbath day can be suspended by virtue of particular acts that transcend the realms of Sabbath normality. For instance, circumcising of a male child if the eighth day falls on the Sabbath. That commandment overrides the Sabbath. The saving of a life in danger overrides the keeping of the Sabbath. Amos mentioned if you have a sack and he's got medicine in there and he needs that, and the synagogue turns around and says, what are you doing? You know, you're carrying a burden. The fact of the matter is, some of those people have walked quite a way to get to the synagogue on the Sabbath, because they can't drive, because to turn the key in the ignition is lighting a fire. So they've got to walk. No matter what the conditions, they've got to walk. And that can be a burden as well. And you were going to say...
I was going to say, the modern world would have brought in even more thought to these subjects.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think as somebody with say, advanced pulmonary disease would have to have their tank of oxygen on its
little
wheelie, and they
absolutely
have to be carrying that and putting that into the pew. And,
that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But hospitality is yet another instance of overriding the Sabbath commandment. I remember I was giving a lecture someplace down south, and at the end of it all, I was so drained by the experience of it. I didn't know what was going on now. I know I can look back and go, oh, the beginning of Meniere's disease. And I really needed something to lift me. And I remember James to me and he said, I bought some cans of bourbon and coke over the road, come and have some. And I was so gratified to hear that. Now, that was the Sabbath. But you know what? He did the right thing. Just letting you know, I know, 20 years later, but that's all right. Hospitality like that, that was important. It was important for me that day. So the humanitarian greater good principle applies in relation to the observance of the Sabbath day, and Yeshua illustrated this with his acts of healing during his ministry. No doubt about that. Absolutely. But for anyone who really wants to know what the truth was about the burdensome laws that they had in the Second Temple period in relation to the Sabbath, and which still apply according to the present religious authorities, I want you, if you've got Google, to access this. I'm putting it up here on the whiteboard, and especially if you're a woman, you'll be overwhelmed by this. Tractate Shabbat 6. This is still... Here it is. Border it with a blue marker. Tractate Shabbat 6. And see about what is permissible and not permissible for a woman to wear on Shabbat. Don't hold your breath while you're reading it. Breathe normally as you read this, because, you know, I just look at that and I think, there it is. Sums the whole thing up. Any modern-day rabbis who argue about laws carrying a mattress in John 5 as untenable and unsubstantiated as occurring in the Second Temple period need a psychiatrist. Because if those laws are still applying to women today, think about the burden that they've created in the Sabbath. It's unbelievable. Alright. But of course, the black comedy is apparent when Yeshua tells the healed man to rise, take up your mattress, bed, mat, whatever. And of course, that item upon which the man has rested for 38 frustrating years was itself a symbol of the Sabbath, a place on which to rest. And yet they come against him because of the symbol of the Sabbath being violated. We all desperately need rest in the man who succeeded Moses. There's no doubt about that. In ancient times, it was Joshua. I agree. It was Joshua who completed the work which the angels of God gave Moses to do, and everything that he had done, Joshua remained faithful to Moses in taking over his position and taking Israel into the Promised Land. But not everybody went into the Promised Land, and Moses didn't go in. Now think of that. Even he didn't go in.
It's interesting that the man whose name is Salvation is the one that brings the people into the Promised Land.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right. Yahushua, God saved. And, you know, if you look at Joshua chapter 1, let's have a quick look here. Joshua chapter 1. Look at verse 7. Be you strong and very courageous, that you may observe to do all according to all the law which Moses my servant commanded you. Turn not from it to the right hand or to the left, that you may prosper whithersoever you go. This book of the law shall not depart out of your mouth. You shall meditate therein day and night, that you may observe to do all according to that which is written therein. Then you shall make your way prosperous. Then you shall have good success. Have not I commanded you? Be strong and of a good courage. Be not afraid. Don't be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. And Joshua held on to that. He held on to those promises. Mm-hmm. He did everything that was right in the sight and expectations of God. He did it all. But Yeshua said the same thing in John 5, verse 19. And just make a mental note on paper, because it's getting late and I just want to finish this. But Yeshua said he was obedient, speaking nothing that the Father had not already given to him to share. So Yeshua did exactly as Joshua in keeping the Father's commandments.
Mm-hmm.
In the Second Temple period, it was and remains Yeshua, the new Joshua, who completed the work which God the Father gave him to do, to accomplish. He cried out, "It is finished. It is finished," from the bloody tree of Golgotha. Yeshua is our rest. Yeshua is our authentic Sabbath. That doesn't negate the keeping of the commandment any more than Yeshua being our lover means that I can go out now and commit adultery. Ridiculous. No. The commandment stays. But we have to look at the commandment in a new way. Granted, that's true. This poor bloke had been subject to despair, rejection, and misery at the Jerusalem swimming pool for 38 long and torturous years. That's a long time. Ancient Israel was 40 years in the wilderness, but 38 of those was constellating around the wilderness area of Petra, of Kadesh Barnea, as a sort of a headquarters. And there's no coincidence that Yeshua chose that man whose time spent on his back or in agony on his bed was 38 years, the very same period of ancient Israel. I've brought this out before. But Yeshua chose this man to heal and to lead him into a positive future, walking about. And Yeshua said, keep walking. Remember that? Keep walking. Without physical impairment or strictures, he was told to keep on walking. What was Yeshua really saying to him? Stop and think for a minute. What was he saying to him? Just think about it. Because in Genesis, there is a Sabbath in view. But you read the account of the seventh day Sabbath in Genesis, you find our first parents walking and talking with God in the cool breeze of the Sabbath day in the evening, it said. And the oneness with their Creator was what constituted holiness. They were walking with their Creator. Apart from a holy God instructing them about two plants, or two trees, there is a total absence of laws, rules, legislation, statutes, ordinances, edicts, because all that came at Sinai. Here was a Sabbath day, the very first Sabbath, where people experienced total freedom. Adam and Eve, in their observance of the first Sabbath, felt absolutely at liberty. They participated in that which constituted holiness because God infused the Sabbath with His Spirit. But isn't that precisely what we all desire? To be free. To have liberty. And what is liberty? Not to be held back in any form or shape or any way. To be centered in the very nature and character. Now, think about it. To be centered in the nature and the character and the holiness of that creative intelligence and love that we inadequately call God.
Yeah.
To be centered in the living Torah, call that Word, Logos, Memra, whatever you want to call it, that created and brought into existence the entirety of the universe. That is what our aim is. Anything less than that, forget it. But God said, I'm going to give it all to you. That's what He meant. The universe is ours. It will be ours. And of course, that kind of freedom is what we all desire. We thirst for it. We hunger for it. I do. I don't know about anybody else. I can only speak for myself.
Galatians says, stand fast therefore in liberty, wherewith Christ has set us free, and be not entangled again with the yoke of bondage.
But we are. We get entangled again. We really do. We get entangled. And I'm going to show you how much that man whom Yeshua healed on the Sabbath day after 48 long years became again entangled. I'm going to show it to you. You read it and you go, it's not there. Yes, it is. I'm going to show it to you. Yeshua came to set the captives free. Yeshua came to give recovery to the sight of the blind. Yeshua came to grant liberty to the oppressed. And we precede all of those because we're first fruits. We're first fruits. Yeshua set this man at liberty to walk and keep on walking. That's what it says in the Greek. Following Yeshua as a disciple. That's what it means to walk. To walk with.
Walk the walk.
To walk the walk. And there is more than a hint here that this man whom Yeshua rescued after 38 years, like he did in ancient times, as God with Israel being led out of the wilderness after that 38-year specific period into the promised land, this was indeed Yeshua's hope that this man would of his own free will say, I am so ecstatic that you have done this for me. I want to follow you. Ancient Israel refused to be so led, so did this man. The record shows that even this man who was healed so miraculously by our Lord Yeshua, who did not even think to thank him, you know, where is that? But you don't find it. He doesn't say, oh, thank you. Thank you, Lord. No, he doesn't think to thank the great physician. Yet when he is confronted by the religious leaders who refer to the illegality of his healing because of sorcery, and that's what came out in his trial, we'll get to that eventually down the track, was so intimidated by these pariahs that when he later met Yeshua, or Yeshua met him, and found out who he was, didn't follow Yeshua as a disciple, but went immediately back to the wrathful Jews, who were thirsty for his blood and betrayed Yeshua to them by name. You might say, well, why? My answer is simple. In order to save his own skin. In order to save his own skin. Because when you think it through, if they were so bent on killing Yeshua for Sabbath breaking, they were also intent on removing the evidence of that same Sabbath breaking. And the evidence was this man who for 38 years had laid under the five porticos of the pool at Bethsaida. And he knew he was history. So he went right back. He said, he did it. No appreciation. None. And here is the reason why Yeshua said, will you be made whole? He got physical healing, but deep down inside his subconscious mind, he was still a rat. He was a rat who said, I don't want to die. He'd been dead for 38 years, for Christ's sake. He had been dead. Yeshua gave him resurrection life. He's alive. He should have been going, oh, hop and dance and speak in tongues. No.
He did it.
That man over there, that naughty Jesus.
Don't you want? I tell you, I read the book Gospel of John. I read it a little bit differently, perhaps, than you may do. But I see between the lines on a lot of this stuff. Yes, Owen. Yeah, that fell on empty ears, didn't it?
Yeah. The worst thing can happen.
That's the worst thing. In conclusion, we have noticed from the start of John's signs that he pens his gospel in such a way that the people of Israel are again and again and again pointed to Yeshua as the Messiah. We all understand that by now. And each sign carries with it a typology of Israel in her historical milieu. The great clue in John is the 38 years of paralytic endurance of a man who spent his life, or much of it, beneath the five porticos of the Torah of Moses at Bethsaida. And this remarkable detail sets the typology for the rest of John's gospel. But if you notice carefully the words of Yeshua relating to his forerunner, John the Baptist, John the Immerser, and again, the religious leaders didn't dispute John's calling because all the people knew he was a prophet. You'll also notice that he ties John the Baptizer in with Moses as a forerunner of Joshua. who eventually led Israel to the promised land over the Jordan. I want you to just look at this before I close. In John chapter 5, where we were to start with, let's turn back there, John chapter 5. Look at verse 33. And when you read and study the Bible, you need to read the context, because you'll get a lot out of the context that doesn't at first reach the eye. In verse 33, it says, "You sent to John, and he bare witness to the truth. But I received not testimony from man, but these things I say, that you might be saved. He was a burning and a shining light, and you were willing for a season to rejoice in his light. But I have a greater witness than that of John." Now, please notice he's talking about John, who was his forerunner. He was his forerunner. And if you drop down to verse 45, "Do not think that I will accuse you to the Father. There is one that accuses you, even Moses, in whom you trust. For had you believed Moses, you would have believed me, for he wrote of me." So he was a forerunner to Joshua, and Joshua, and the theme of forerunner, is there in this chapter in relation to Yochanan the Immerser and Moses himself. "You would have believed me, for he wrote of me. If you believe not his writings, how shall you believe my words?" So the Apostle John's priestly colleagues would be reading this. They must have been experiencing some far-reaching conclusions as they read and then probably shared this gospel concerning the ministry and work of Yeshua as the promised Messiah. So this period in the wilderness, at the time of Moses and of Yochanan, the forerunner, is coming to an end. That's why John is writing this gospel. Because for John the Apostle, it was high time for the remnant of the true people of God. And remember, there's always a remnant of the true people of God. It was time for them to enter the authentic Sabbath of eternal life, following the new Joshua. Now, none of this negates, as I said, the responsibility of keeping the commandments of God, including the fourth, of course. But we must observe it in newness of resurrection life. And if these things apply so dramatically to John way back in the Second Temple period, where he drew these comparisons, where he took time to relate these incidents, where he spoke in such a way that you could then read between the lines, if you could see what he was getting at, because he thought the time was fast approaching when the end of the age was dawning, how much more should each of us, both here at the Yeshiva and those listening overseas, how much more so with us today, as we do see the end of the age rapidly approaching? Are there any questions on any of that?